Okay, the Chula Tanha Sankhaya Sutta, shorter discourse on the ending of craving, is concerned with a short instruction given by the Buddha to Sakka, the king of the gods. This discourse has two parallels, which are found in the Samyukta Agama and the Ekotara Agama. So no parallels in the Madhyama Agama and none in Sanskrit either. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in the Eastern Park in the palace of Megara's mother. Then Sakka, ruler of the gods, went to the Blessed One and, after paying homage to him, he stood to one side and asked, "Venerable Sir, how, in brief, is a bhikkhu liberated in the destruction of craving, one who has, or in the ending of craving, one who has reached the ultimate end, the ultimate security from bondage, the ultimate holy life, the ultimate goal, one who is foremost among gods and humans?" Okay, so notice the usage here where it talks about Sakka, the name of Sakka. Sakka has many titles, okay, and he's called different things in different places, but here is one of the most common titles, Devanamindo. So Devanam means of the devas. Inda literally means like the lord or the ruler. Okay, so notice his title in the Pali is the Inda. And of course, this is a remnant of his more usual title in the Vedas, in the Vedic literature, where he is, of course, is Indra. And as Indra, he's like a war god of the from the Rig Veda. In Pali, he's become much more soft and gentle in character. And often in contexts like the one we have here, he's seen in quite a almost like a satirical light. He's a bit of a kind of an object of joke rather than of reverence and fear. What I might do for this class, we've been doing a little bit of finding out a little bit of grammar with each lesson, and so what I might do this week is point out a few instances of the case known as the dative and genitive case. So we've done so far of the nouns and adjectives. We've done the nominative, such as Sakko Devanamindo, nominative singular. And we've done the accusative, so the nominative usually the subject of the verb. We've done the accusative, which is usually the object of the verb. Here, Bhagavantang, and here the verb itself said this. So Devanamindo Bhagavantang Etnadavocha. Sakka, the king of gods, said to the Blessed One. Okay, and so this is as far as we've gone with our grammar, is this kind of very basic declarative sentence. And what I might do now is just discuss another case of nouns and adjectives. In this case, we call the dative case or the genitive case. Now, these are actually two separate grammatical categories, but they overlap. They always have the same form. Okay, so you can't distinguish between the dative and the genitive in terms of form. They always look the same, with one minor exception. There is a special dative case which is used occasionally. For example, in the phrase Namo Buddhaya, remember when we went to the Christian nunnery and they said they were doing Namo Christaya meditation? So that is an archaic dative form, the aya at the end of Namo Christaya, which is derived from Vedic language. So that's an unusual dative form. It's used in a poetic context. But normally the dative and genitive have the same form, and also the meaning of them overlaps. So to a certain extent, it's sometimes a bit of pedantry to try to work out whether it should be classed as dative or genitive. But the basic idea is that dative is concerned with doing something to or for someone or something. Okay, so dative can often be translated by for. Okay, whereas the genitive means of something. Okay, so genitive can often be translated in English as of. So dative means for, and genitive means of. And so have a look at a few of these cases as they come up. We already noticed one case here, Devanamindo. The Devanang is a genitive plural of gods. Okay, so Devanamindo, of the gods. Okay, so Deva is a god. Deva is the gods. Devanang is the genitive plural, the lord of the gods. Okay, and that form is also became very common as the epithet of King Ashoka, who was known as Devanampriya, the beloved of the gods. Okay, so here we translate ruler of the gods the word of being expressed by the grammatical case. Okay. So again, remember, I'm not trying to give a full and complete description of all of these things as we go past, but just to get some kind of idea. So even if you just get some idea of how the grammar kind of works, then that's good enough for now. We're not trying to do sort of technical grammatical lessons, but just trying to get some kind of idea of how the sentences are constructed. Okay, so to what extent, Bhante, is a bhikkhu sankhittena in brief? Tanha sankhaya vimutto, released with the ending, sankhaya of craving, tanha. Achanta nitho. So this is the word that Bhikkhu Bodhi is translated as ultimate. Okay, achanta. Okay, and here this is from the word anta, meaning end. Okay, and acha is actually the prefix ati. And when ati occurs before a vowel like this, it changes to ach. Okay, so achanta means the extreme end. So Bhikkhu Bodhi is translated as ultimate. Extreme end has ended. Achanta yoga kemi is free from exertion or bondage. Achanta brahmachari, okay, so it's the ultimate holy life. Achanta pariyosano, and so he's the ultimate, how do you translate that? The ultimate goal, one who's foremost among gods and men, okay? And again, here is the genitive plural, devamanusanang, okay, foremost, so the best, so foremost, of gods and men, okay? Now, the Buddha replied, here, ruler of gods, a bhikkhu has heard that nothing is worth adhering to. Sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesayati, okay? Sabbe dhamma nalang abhinivesayati. This is a very beautiful phrase. Nothing, this one was often quoted by Ajahn Buddhadasa. And sometimes they would translate it in his works, they would translate it as something like, nothing whatsoever is worth having or being, something like that. And it's also found in I think, the instructions to Mahamoggallana, when he was nodding, actually connection with Moggallana here. All dhammas not worth abhinivesa, insisting on. Okay, so this is a word for defilements, but it's a word for defilements of what happens when you insist it must be like this and can't be any other way. Okay, so we would call that abhinivesa. When a bhikkhu has heard that nothing is worth adhering to, he directly knows everything. Okay, so sabbang dhammang abhijanati. Okay, so this is the technical word abhijanati. Okay, so having directly known everything, sabbang dhammang parijanati, he fully knows everything. So in the Buddhist context or the Pali context, these words abhijanati, abhijanati is the same word that we know from the six abhinya, the six direct knowledges, as Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it. And so this is just the verb form of that. So as the six abhinya goes all the way from the psychic powers and divine ear, divine eye and so on, right up into the ending of the asavas, and these are all called abhinya, okay? But when it's used in contrast with parijanati, then parijanati is more exalted. So this is a parinya, and this is almost always used to mean, specifically to mean arahantship, okay? So parijanati almost always means arahantship, whereas abhijanati might mean any kind of higher knowledge, okay? So parijanati is more exalted. Seems to me slightly odd why it uses parijanati right here in the phrase, because then it goes on to talk about the course of developing vipassana leading to arahantship. Whereas Wusu Parijanati seems to imply arahantship already. But anyway, having fully understand everything, whatever he feels, whether pleasant, okay, yang kinchi, whatever, vedanang vedeti, whatever feeling he feels, whether pleasant or painful or not painful and not pleasant or, right? So, and then, regarding those feelings, he abides contemplating impermanence. Okay, he abides contemplating anupassi, dispassion or fading away, viraga. He abides contemplating anupassi, nirodha, ending. He abides contemplating relinquishment. So again, it's a very beautiful set of words. describing the course of insight. And the same words are used in the Anapanasati Sutta, the final tetrad of Anapanasati. Okay, so this is, you know, you can, it's useful. This is one of the reasons why it's useful to work from the Pali, is because you can see these things with a lot more precision than you can in the translation. I mean, of course, Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations are very precise, but it's more striking, the parallels, when you see them. And you know, you can see that in the Anapanasati Sutta. How's it going? Asasisamiti sikkhati, anicca-anupassi wa asasisamiti sikkhati, viraga-anupassi asasisamiti sikkhati, nirodha-anupassi asasisamiti sikkhati, parinisagga-anupassi asasisamiti sikkhati. So this is the phrasing in the Anapanasati Sutta, exactly parallel. So obviously when you see those very strong parallels, you realize it's talking about exactly the same thing. And that's useful because, as always, it's helping to put that in a context, okay? So here, all we have is really a very direct teaching on a very, very deep level of insight, okay? He's not explaining the whole course of practice. He's not teaching Sila, Samadhi, Panya, the whole Eightfold Path, anything like that. The question was, how do you get completely released from all kinds of craving, yeah? And he's given the answer which just goes straight to that. This is how you do that, yeah? And so, that's when you can then see it, you can then understand what he's teaching here, and you can also understand how that fits in with the context in the broader teachings on the path. Bhakti nisagga is letting go, relinquishment, I translate. Bhakti nisagga.
And then nirodha.
Nirodha?
Pati?
Yep. Contemplating cessation?
That's contemplating cessation.
Okay, so thus contemplating, then one does not cling, nakinchi loke upadiyati, and does not grasp at anything in the world. Okay, and again, that phrase is lifted straight out of the Satipatthana Sutta. Okay, one doesn't grasp at everything else, at anything in the world, nakinchi loke upadiyati. Okay. And then the kind of the interesting one, and not grasping, one does not paritasati. Paritasati is one of these words which is from a conflated root in Pali. So it's actually one word in Pali which stands for two quite different roots in Sanskrit or in other dialects, and they come together in Pali, and they're often used with this kind of ambiguous sense. One root is tanha. Okay, so one root is from the same root as the word tanha, as craving. Okay, and that word tanha is a peculiarly Pali form. Actually, in the Sanskrit form is trishna. Okay, of tanha, trishna, and it's useful to know these things. And I found that useful when I was in Delhi, and we were staying in a hotel there, and we were walking past, and the bar was called the Trishna Bar. Okay. That was very appropriate. So one word meaning thirst, okay, so the literal root of that is to thirst, and it's the same as the English word thirst, okay? And the other root is the root meaning to burn up to or to have a fever, okay? So this is the two meanings, one is to thirst and the other is to fever, which are both combined in this paritasati. And so this is the word Bhikkhu Bodhi suggests is closest to this kind of existential sense of angst or dislocation. It's a kind of modern understanding of it. How does Bhikkhu Bodhi translate it here? Not agitated. Bhikkhu Bodhi translate agitated. I kind of prefer anxious. One is not anxious. Anyway. Aparitasanam. Pachatan yeva parinibhayati. Right internally, eva. Right or just internally, parinibhayati. One parinibhanas. One goes completely out. Okay. So notice how that we were talking about this the other day. That when nibbana is expressed in the Pali, it's expressed in a verbal form. So one parinibhanas. Okay. One doesn't enter parinibhana as if parinibhana is a place or a thing that one goes into, but one parinibbana is one goes out. And of course, one of the standard expressions of Arahantship, kīrṇa jāti, birth is ended, holy life has been lived, what done is what should be done, there's no returning to this state of being, okay? Itadayati. There's no returning to this state of being. I'm just wondering whether itadaya is a dative case or a locative case. I mentioned before that the dative and genitive have the same cases. They always appear the same in Pali. And the confusing thing is that is especially in feminine roots that they often appear the same as other cases as well. Alright? So it's quite a bit difficult to work out which one is which sometimes. So this one could be understood as either dative or perhaps as locative. One does not return to any state of being. Okay, so there's no returning to any state of being, or there is no returning in any state of being. So it could perhaps be interpreted both ways, I'm not quite sure of that one. Certainly translated as no returning to any state of being, which would imply it's a dative case. Okay. So notice that these cases that we've already, you know, we haven't gone very far, but we're already, the cases occurring much more rarely than they were before. We're looking at the nominative and accusative. They come up in virtually every sentence. It's almost, you know, you almost can't construct sentences without them. You probably could if you really tried, but it's pretty unusual, whereas these cases only occur sometimes, other times they don't. Okay, so this is the answer to the question. Now, then Sakha, the rule of gods, delighting and rejoicing in the Blessed One's words, paid homage to the Blessed One and keeping on his right, he vanished right there. Okay? Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Mahamoggallana was sitting not far from the Blessed One. And then he considered, did that spirit, that yaka, okay, again, using the word yaka, did that yaka penetrate to the meaning of the Blessed One's words when he rejoiced, or did he not? Okay, yariwa so yakho bhagavato bhasitanga bhisamecha anumori yariwa noti. Okay, so this is kind of idiom. Did he or did he not? So the yadi wa or is the va is an or. Yadi it means literally if. So yadi wa, and again comes at the beginning and the end of the sentence. Yadi wa, did he or did he not? Okay, yadi wa no, and that's the no comes at the end of the sentence. Okay, so then disappearing, he went to, just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm or flex his extended arm, the Venerable Mahamoggallana vanished from the palace of Migara's mother in the Eastern Park and appeared among the gods of the 33. Okay.
Mahamoggallana, he's an Arahant, yeah?
Yeah.
Not a Buddha. So can Mahabuddha vanish and reappear in the...
I don't know. I have to ask him.
In terms of his achievements, he was very highly accomplished. He was one of the chief disciples.
Yeah. So not all these abilities are kind of, these are like the extra CD player you put in your car and these kinds of things.
Like the extra, you get.
Yeah.
And then you get the extra car.
That's right. It still goes the same, right? You still go to Nibbana the same, but, you know, do you get to play an extra CD on the way or something like that? That's the difference. So, you know, Moggallana could have some fun doing these kinds of things. Right. Now, on that occasion, Sakha, the rule of gods, was furnished and endowed a hundredfold with the five kinds of heavenly music. Okay? Dibehi panchahi turiya satehi. So turiya, the word for music here. Okay, so there's 500 kinds of heavenly music. And he was enjoying it in the pleasure park of the single lotus. Okay? Eka pundarika uyana. Okay? Single lotus pleasure park. So, you know, you can use your imagination to work out what the single lotus pleasure park means. Maybe it's like a whole park they've created. They've made a lotus for the devas to play in. You know, it's like 100 miles across or something like that. And there's all divine musicians floating through the air and all of these kinds of things. I don't know. So, he saw the Venerable Mahamoggallana coming in the distance. He dismissed the music went up to the vet. See, they didn't need iPods in those days. Went up to the, and no one mugged you to take them off. And went to Moggallana and said to him, "Come, good sir, Moggallana, welcome, good sir, Moggallana. It is long, good sir, Moggallana, since you found an opportunity to come here. Sit down, good sir, Moggallana. This seat is ready." So, ehi ko marisa. So marisa, when it's translated as good sir, it's got nothing to do with Mara as in our friend. It's Mara is just a term of address used by the devas. Okay, I think it may be like an archaic Vedic form of address, just meaning, you know, sir or something like that. So they use the word marisa. Sagatam. Sagatam. So this is su. Agatang. Su meaning well, agatang meaning come, welcome, which we translate as welcome. It's been a long time since the since Moggallana has made the chance to come here, Idhagamanaya. Please sit, Nisida, have a seat, Moggallana, and then I will sit. Idamasanang, and he'll sit on the I'll set the seat for you. So this is the right way and polite way to greet incoming monks into the monastery. So whenever you see monks coming or nuns coming, then this is what you do. Yeah, you don't walk away and think it's somebody else's problem, right? You immediately leave aside whatever you're doing and you go out and you say, "Oh, welcome, it's very good to see you, please come in, have a seat. The bathroom's over here if you need to use the bathroom. Here's bring a glass of water or something to drink. And, ask about their health and whether they're well. And is there anything that you can do to help them?" Yeah, and that's the appropriate way to receive somebody who's visiting monk or nun. And then, Mahamoggallana sat down on a seat made ready, and Sakka took a low seat and sat down at one side. Okay, I should just backtrack a little bit here to the comparative study. Pali and Ekotra versions report in similar terms how that Sakka paid a visit to the Buddha and how a monk reaches the destruction of craving. The Pali version reports the Buddha replying that a monk who's heard that nothing is worth adhering to develops direct understanding and contemplates the three feelings from the perspective of impermanence, fading away, cessation, and relinquishment. The Ekotra Agama account similarly speaks of not clinging to anything and of contemplating the three feelings of impermanent and subject to cessation. So the Ekotra Agama is similar. In addition to the Pali instructions, the Ekotra Agama version relates not clinging to any phenomena to insight into their empty and insubstantial nature. Okay, so it adds a little bit extra on emptiness there. The same version, moreover, mentions the absence of worldly perceptions as an intermediate step between contemplation of the three feelings and absence of agitation that leads up to attaining nibbana. So, slight difference in the phrasing, but no real difference in the meaning there. Sanyukta Agama version, however, does not have the instruction given by the Buddha at all. This version begins with Mahamoggallana, who was alone in seclusion on Mount Gijjhakuta, remembering that on a former occasion Sakka had approached the Buddha and inquired about the destruction of craving. In agreeing with the other two versions, the Sanyukta Agama discourse reports Mahamoggallana appearing in the heaven of the 33 to find out whether Sakka had really comprehended the Buddha's instructions. So, Venerable Analaya then goes on to point out that Sakka's question here is following on from his earlier encounter with the Buddha in the Sakka Panha Sutta, and in fact some of the terminology in this one and in the Sakkapanha Sutta, which is in the Digha Nikaya, one of the most literarily interesting suttas in the Digha Nikaya, and with really good Dhamma in it as well, was in one of the caves. It's actually found cave. So if you go to India, you can actually, I've never been there, but you can actually visit the cave where Sakka came to ask the question of the Buddha. And
Sakka.
Because there was inscriptions there, yeah, and carvings and things like that. So so obviously the ancients believed it was there. Yeah, how they knew. There's another question, yeah. But there's not actually a huge amount of caves in the area, as it happens, you know. It's a bit rugged and hilly, but it's not like there's huge amounts of caves around the place. Yeah. Okay, so just to come back again, that the basic instruction is given three times altogether in the sutta, okay? And in the Ekotra Agama versions, these three instances differ considerably from each other, okay? So each time the same instruction is given, but it's given in quite a different way each time it's given, and that's in the Ekotra Agama. And we've already talked about this several times, the Ekotra Agama, that's entirely typical of the Ekotra Agama, which is appallingly badly translated and edited. And is highly inconsistent, even within the same sutta, has very often glaring mistakes and inconsistencies. Quite possibly, some of that problem is due to the Indic text. If it is based on a Mahasanghika text, their texts were in Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit, which are notoriously difficult. And no doubt, there also seems to have been some problem with the translation, perhaps that the translator just did a draft and never got around to revising it or something like that. In any case, we do have these kinds of problems there. Now, both the Sakkapanha Sutta and the current sutta use the same phrasing of being liberated through the destruction of craving, Dhanha Sankhaya Vimutta, and of reaching the ultimate end, the ultimate security from bondage, the ultimate holy life, the ultimate goal. Achanta Nitta, Achanta Yoga, Kemi, Achanta Brahmachari, Achanta Pariyosana. Okay, and they both refer to Sakka talking about a previous occasion when the Devas defeated the Asuras in battle. So there's some significant parallels there. However, the setting is quite different. In the Sakkapanha Sutta, Sakka wouldn't even go near the Buddha, right? He was just too nervous. And so to attract the Buddha's attention, he sent Panchasika, the Gandhaba, to sing a love song to the Buddha. Okay? And this being renowned as the only love song in the Pali language, quite probably. So have the Buddha's attention having been got with that, as you would imagine, it would be a useful device for getting the Buddha's attention, then only then would Sakka go. But in this case, Sakka appears very casual and very self-confident. Okay, so then Analo comments, we're coming up to where we are now in the sutta about sitting on a lower seat. That's certainly unusual. Normally the devas will stand in the presence of monks and not sit. Then Mahamoggallana then asked him, Kosiya. Okay, so this being another one of the titles of Sakka. And in the Sakka Sanghita, in the Sanghita Nikaya, it goes to some detail with some of the different titles and names of Sakka, Kosiya being one of them. How did the Blessed One say to you in brief deliverance in the destruction of craving? It would be good if we might also get to hear that statement. Okay, to which Sakka says, well, Moggallana, we are very busy and I've got a lot of things to do, not only with our own business, but also with the business of the gods of the 33. Besides, good Sir Moggallana, what has been well heard, well learned, well attended to, well remembered, suddenly vanishes from us. So, obviously, yeah, he's obviously preparing for a career in Australian politics. Or past politics anywhere in the world. I don't want to be too nasty to the Australian politicians. My uncle, Bahu Kicha, many duties, Bahu Karaniya, many things to do. Apeva Sakena Karaniyena, not only my own Sakka, so here's Sakka with one K, not the Sakka as in with two Ks, the name of the god. Sakka with one K, it means one's own. Sakena Karaniyena, not to speak of one's own business, apicha devanam yeva tavatingsanam karaniyena, with the businesses of the gods of 33. So here again we have the dative case, here probably the, okay, so the devanam, again the same case, the dative or genitive, and the tavatingsanam, dative or genitive. And so this could be translated in either way. You could translate it, things to be done, the duties to be done of the gods of 33. Okay, so the duties, not only do I have to look after my own duties, I have to look after the duties of the gods of 33. Or you could translate it as for Yeah, as in the dative sense. Not in my only duties, but also I have to do duties for the gods of the 33. Okay? So these are technically different grammatical cases, but often, as in cases like this, the difference is really nominal, and you could really translate it either way. Okay. And then many, what has been well heard, so sutang, well heard, well grabbed hold of, su manasikatang, well attended to, su padharitang, well remembered, yang no kipameva antaradhayati, kipameva, like that, vanish. Of course, I'm sure that's not the experience of anyone in our sutta classes, because we all remember those things that have been, take them away and never forget them. Okay. Now, good sir, Moggallana, it once happened that war broke out between the gods and the asuras. In that war, the gods won and the asuras were defeated. Okay? So notice here, this is the this classic image, Deva Asura, Sangamo, Deva Asura Sangamo, the war, Sangama, Sangama, between the Devas and the asuras. Okay? And it's this classic imagery which found all through mythology, of the war between the different orders of divine beings, and typically the earlier and the older divine beings, they're often depicted as like monsters. So like in the you have like Leviathan in the Bible, and the Tiamat in the Lebanese or Syrian mythology. You have the Echidna is another one, the Sphinx is another one. So many different kinds of monsters, and often conceived as being like kind of pre-human or sub-human, kind of formless, shapeless, kind of mountains of power, but not usually hugely intelligent. And they become overcome by the more humanized devas. Okay, and of course that can be read on many different terms. It can be read in historical terms as the replacement. In some cases, maybe a violent suppression, in other cases a natural evolution from more primitive forms of religious worship, which tend to worship deities in animal form, towards a more refined form of worship, which represents the gods in a human form. Can also be understood, of course, in terms of a similar parallel within individual psychology, that a person, you know, the asuras represent the more primitive sort of animal drives in the mind, the drives to power and thirst for power and pleasure and so on, whereas the devas represent the more refined aspects of consciousness and so on. So these things can always be understood in many different ways. Of course, in Greek mythology is the battles between the gods and the titans. So this is why often the asura is translated as titan. Okay. Now, In that war, the devas won. Of course, in the Buddhist, needs to be mentioned, in the Buddhist version, it's never particularly violent. Like in the Greek mythology, if you read the Greek mythology, it's this kind of overwhelming sense of degradation and perversion and utter incomprehensible violence that's going on all the time. It's just the levels of twistedness and sickness in the violence that's being perpetrated are almost inconceivable. You know, how did people possibly imagine these kinds of things? And whereas in the Buddhist versions, it's all, you know, it's more like a kind of a, you know, yeah, something like a tea party or something like that. They kind of chase each other around, you know. The best example of that is where the asuras won the battle, the devas are running away, but as they were running away, these little ducklings were crossing the road in front of them. And so they stopped. They wouldn't drive their chariots over the ducklings on the road, or where they were, little baby birds or something, they wouldn't drive their chariots over the top of them, so they stopped, you know. And when the asuras behind them saw them stopping, they thought, oh, they must have got reinforcements, they're coming back to get us now. So the asuras turned around and ran away. And so that's how they won that war. So, and it's, you know, it's interesting, you know, the way that these things are depicted shows how, if we think of these things as being different aspects of the mind, then the way that they relate to each other shows how the people who created these stories related to these different aspects of their mind, yeah? And if you're depicting this war as being this hideous, violent cleavage and destruction, Well, that's a sign. Well, where do those ideas come from? Yeah, they obviously come from the mind. Yeah, and but if it's depicted in the sense, well, there's a difference and there's a conflict, but it's a fairly, you know, a gentle one. It's a workable one. It's a negotiable one. Yeah, and then it's a much healthier way of seeing things. Okay, so when I'd won that war and returned from it, as a consequence, I had the Vajrayanta palace built. So the Vajrayanta is the word meaning victory. And good Sir Moggallana, the Vajrayanta palace has 100 towers, and each tower has 700 upper chambers. And every upper chamber has 7 nymphs, and each nymph has 7 maids. Would you like to see the loveliness of the Vajrayanta palace, the good Sir Moggallana? Venerable Maha Moggallana consented in silence. I don't know if that was such a good idea. But, so the thing is, because the Achara is the nymphs, and the Paricharika is the maids, the looker after it. Right, so what happens next? So Moggallana consented in silence. Then Taka, ruler of gods, and the divine king Vesavana went to the Vajrayanta palace. So Vesavana seems to have been just hanging around there. Everybody has a little note there. He hasn't been in the story up until now, 399. One of the 4 great kings, the ruler of the Yakas. So, okay. Taka went to the Vajrayanta palace, giving precedence to the venerable Maha Moggallana. I mean, sending him in the front. When the maids of Saka saw the Venerable Maha Moggallana coming in the distance, they were embarrassed and ashamed, and they went each into their own rooms. Just as a daughter-in-law is embarrassed and ashamed on seeing her father-in-law, so too, when the maids of Saka saw the Venerable Maha Moggallana coming, they were embarrassed and ashamed, and they went each into their own rooms. Okay, so according to the Sanyukta Agama version, when the maidens had seen the people coming, and they thought that it was Saka coming, they came out playing music and dancing to greet them and bring them into the palace. And then when they realized that there was a monk with them, that was why they got embarrassed and went off. And also the Pali and the Sanyukta Agama versions compare the embarrassment of the embarrassment that a woman seeing daughter-in-law experiences on seeing her father-in-law. This simile is not entirely clear, according to Venerable Analia, since one may wonder why a woman who, according to an Indian custom, has to go to live with her husband's family would feel ashamed when she meets her father-in-law. Perhaps he suggests this might be because of the crowded housing conditions in India. I don't know if that's particularly pertinent, but he quotes here a fellow called Weigel, who explains that a bride on marriage goes to the family of her husband, which is alien to her, while she sees her husband and his parents as a single category to whom she owes respect and obedience. They in turn see her as an alien coming to seek membership. So that doesn't mean she's come down on a spaceship or anything. She's just an outsider. So, but it's somewhat curious simile, but I guess we just have to accept that that's how it was in ancient India, that there's that kind of nervousness. But you can understand that they'd be a bit nervous and so on.
Would it not be the case that they may not have been entirely dressed appropriately for somebody of a holy disposition?
Well, that may well have been the case, yeah, judging from the images that we've seen. Then, Saka, the ruler of gods, and King Vesavana and Moggallana walked all over and explored the Vajrayanta palace. See, good Sir Moggallana, this loveliness of the Vajrayanta palace. See, good Sir Moggallana, this loveliness of the Vajrayanta palace. And then Moggallana replied, does the Venerable Kosiya merit? So notice the use of the word venerable here. Where have we? Ayasmato. Okay. Okay, so this is the normal use for venerable. And this again is a dative genitive case here. Of the venerable Kosiya, or for the Venerable Kosiya. Translate it either way. Katapunyasa, pube katapunyasa. It is illumination. It is the illumination, sobhati, of one who has formerly done merit. Okay, so the genitive case here. or illumination for one who's done merit, dative case, katapunyasa. Okay? Then Venerable Mahamoggallana considered thus, this spirit is living much too negligently. Yeah, ati barlahang.
What's the word for negligent?
Pamatto viharati. Why don't I stir up this yaka? So sangveje yanti. Okay, so we've noticed this word again before. Sangvijati or sangvega is the noun form. Why don't I stir him up, arouse a sense of urgency? Okay, then Venerable Mahamoggallana made such a kind of tatarupang idhabhi sankarang, an act of psychic power. Abhisankasi. He acted an act of psychic power, such that the Vajayanta Palace padangu takena sankapesi sampakampesi sampavedhesi was shaken with the toe of his foot. Right. So this is obviously Saka being very proud of his dwelling, showing them around, just like I show people around the monastery when they come here. And I say, oh, look at all these lovely things we've done. He said, oh, he's being much too negligent. And so he wanted to stir him up. Now, according to the commentary and the way, the classical way this is understood in the Theravadan tradition, if you want to do this, you have to practice water kasina. Okay? So you go into water kasina, and then you determine that the foundations of the Vajayanta palace are made of water. Okay? And then it starts to rock and shake as if it's standing on water. Okay? So that's how to do it. Right? Just in case you need to know.
Where's kasina? Is that
element? Kasina is like the... it's usually like the meditation on either the four colours or the four elements. But where you do like a, you basically, you, usually it's you get a disc or something like that, some kind of external object, and then you contemplate that, and then you use that as your object of samadhi. Yeah, and typically they say that you get like control over certain elements or aspects which are similar to those of the kasinas themselves. Yeah, so if you do like air kasina, then you can control the winds and things like that. So if you want to like walk on water, then you do earth kasina and you determine the water is earth and so on. Okay, then Saka and the divine king Vesavana and the gods of the 33 were filled with wonder and amazement, and they said, "Sirs, it is wonderful, it is marvelous, what power and might the recluse has, that with his toe he makes the heavenly abode shake and quake and tremble." Then, when the Venerable Mahamoggallana knew that Saka was stirred to a sense of urgency with his hair standing on end, he then asked him, "Kosya, how did the Blessed One state to you in brief deliverance on the destruction of craving? It would be good if we might also get to hear that statement." Then Saka repeated the discourse that was gone on before. Oh, something I forgot to mention, I should have mentioned earlier when talking about the Sakapanha Sutta, is that he'd already become a stream enterer, okay? So he was already a stream enterer in the Sakapanha Sutta. So here is a stream enterer. So even a stream enterer can be negligent, okay? Then Mahamoggallana vanished from there and reappeared in the eastern park in the palace of Megara's mother. Then soon after he had departed, the attendants of Saka, ruler of gods, asked him, "Good sir, was that your teacher, the Blessed One?" "No, good sirs, that was not my teacher, the Blessed One. That was one of my companions in the holy life, the Venerable Mahamoggallana." Okay, so this is why he refers to him as a companion in his holy life, because he was also a stream enterer, so they're both Arya Pugala. "Good sir, it is a gain for you that your companion in the holy life was so powerful and mighty. Oh, how much more so must be the Blessed One, your teacher." So then Mahamoggallana went to the Blessed One, paid respects to him, and then asked him about this teaching. And so then Moggallana delighted and rejoiced in the words of the Blessed One. I heard it again. So it's a very lovely sutta, very one of those suttas that has a very powerful punch to it. The actual teachings in there are very succinct and very central, really going to the heart of the matter. And yet put within a very quite delightful and light-hearted kind of narrative context. Perhaps Saka, the king of gods, didn't think it was so light-hearted. but just to see that it's really, it's just that, that attitude towards these kinds of things is always very typical of early Buddhism, of that this kind of gentle kind of satire and humour.
Okay, a question that's a little off from being on but off the subject. When we were talking the other day about bodhisattvas, you said, well, I want to be in a discussion with scholars, not with someone who's just talking about their practice.
No, I didn't sense that.
Well, anyway, so maybe I misheard you. As a scholar, do you take your practice as the final test when you can? Does this make sense to you? Can I adopt this as truth?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. No. I think you misunderstood what I was saying. I was just saying that. That in that kind of dialogue, people need to be meeting at the same level, whatever that level is.
Yeah.
So I wasn't saying that one way of doing it is better than another. But if one person's coming from a scholarly perspective and another one says, well, from my experience, this is like that, then you just can't actually say that much to each other. So that was my concern. Like, if you want to have that kind of dialogue, you have to speak the same language, you know, and this is what I've found hasn't happened. Maybe.
Tell me more about it, because I really want to understand it, but can you give me an example?
Oh, well, I mean, just as a practical example, when I went to Perth last year, I gave a talk on that topic, and it was one of the topics that we were invited to speak on was the Arahant versus the Bodhisattva. And you know, Ajahn Brahm was deliberately trying to set it up as being very controversial and trying to get people to argue with each other and to say controversial things. And I thought, all right, well, I'll do it then. And so I got up and my bit, you know, pointed out that in the suttas that doesn't make an opposition between the benefit of oneself and the benefit of others. Yeah, so I pointed out that it actually talks as you practice for your own benefit, the benefit of others, and for the benefit of both. Yeah, so it actually moved towards a synthesis rather than an opposition between them. And so then just pointing out, well, a lot of the opposition between these ideas is something that arose through history as different kind of groups of people sort of, you know, use kind of rhetoric and arguing with each other, and then we take that to be, you know, an expression of the ultimate truth, whereas in fact it's just the position of a group of people at a point in time. And other people got up, say Venerable Hui Khan got up, and it was very kind of well received and so on, but then Venerable Hui Khan got up, and she just told some stories, about some Bodhisattva stories. Right, so she didn't address any of the things that I'd raised at all, but she told very, very lovely stories, which, you know, I still remember and I still use them in my talk, yeah, and were really nice, but they didn't engage in the issues that I was talking about, yeah. So this is just been my experience in most of the places, that that's how things happen. So rather than, you know, doing them from me. Yeah.
Chronologically
before this one, yeah. Yeah. Already Aryapugala. Yeah. That's right, yeah. So we don't have the absolute chronology, we don't know exactly when these things happened, but we do know that this one was after.
Was it in Sakkapanna one that he became a Sotapanna?
Yep.
During that?
Yep.
He was about to die, and then...
Was he about to die?
Yeah, that's when he came.
Was he? I can't remember. You may be right, I just can't remember that particular detail.
He became the new Sakkadena there. He was fading away. Wasn't that something?
I can't remember that bit.
Towards the end, it says, end of the...
I can't remember. I would have to check that to say that I can't remember. Yeah, but I mean that's also very similar to this in that it's got this kind of quite light-hearted you know, story, you know, about the Panchasika coming and singing the love song and all of these kinds of things. And it's quite amusing. But actually, when you get into the core of the Dhamma, it's got some really powerful Dhamma teachings in there. Yeah, they're quite nice. I can't remember that about Saka dying or being dying in that, but we can check that.
Very last of the bottom of
at the end of the sutta. I have to check.
I thought he went up there with Buddha went up there with Mahamoggallana and a couple of other great disciples, and they were doing this levitating in the four quarters business, displaying psychic powers. That may be.
No, that was Brahmani Mantika Sutta. It's in Majjhima Nikaya, a different one. I think. Now, on that occasion, then this strong desire arose in Saka to see the Blessed One. And then he thought to himself, now, how can I go and see the Blessed One? And then he said, oh, where is it? Where is it the Blessed One now staying? And then he said, oh, he's staying in Magadha. Okay, so in the Ambasanda Brahmin village. And then he thought, So then he called Gandhar. This is kind of complex relationship between Saka, I think, and Saka and this Panchasikara, and then who was someone's daughter, and they were fall in love, and they wanted to get the daughter Suryavachasa. Yeah. So he goes to the Buddha and then went to the Blessed One. The Gandharva went to the Blessed One and then paid respect and then spoke these verses connected with the Buddha, the Dhamma, Sangha, the Arahants, and love. homage to your father, the great Timburung, the Turiyawachasa, the one who gave birth to such a lovely maiden. The one who gives me such joy, and just like the cool breeze to one who is hot, or to a thirst-quenching drink to one who's thirsty, you delight me just as the Dhamma delights the Arahants. You're delightful to me just as the Dhamma is delightful to the Arahants, and. This one was supposed to be given just after the Buddha's enlightenment. So, yeah, I won't try to translate the whole thing. I'll just go to the end of it. If you said at the end... okay, so then... and he finishes, he says, Sakadeva Anamindo said to Panchasikara, you've been very helpful that you went to the Blessed One first and got me a chance to go and see the... Blessed One, so now I give you Suryavachasa as a prize. And then Saka gave out the following saying, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. And during this discourse, then he became a stream enterer. Yeah, it doesn't say anything about him dying or anything like that. As there might have been a commentary or background story to it or something like that, I'm not sure. Yeah. Bhikkhu Bodhi hasn't translated this sutta, as far as I know. It's not in... Sakapanha is in the Digha Nikaya, so maybe another sutta concerning Saka that you're thinking of?
The Sakapanha, but it's the green one, in green color.
The green one is the Digha Nikaya.
And the brown one?
Majjhima Nikaya.
Oh, okay. Somebody else has...
I'm not sure. Yeah. But there's a whole Sanyutta in the Saka Sanyutta, so it may be one of those that you're thinking about. Yeah.
There's a story of Saka that clearly had jhanas and went up to the Deva realm and then came down, became a stream enterer, and continued to live as a god.
Yeah, I don't know.
There's nothing that tells you earlier than.
No. Yeah, not necessarily. Not necessarily, no. Yeah. You're born into the Brahma realm because of the power of jhanas, but not necessarily everyone who gets jhanas gets reborn in the Brahma realm, because it depends on other thing and the strength and how often you've done it and all kinds of things. It's not like it's not an it's not a kind of certain rebirth because of that. No, he's only Tavatimsa Devas. He's hardly rates a mention in the Brahmas. Brahma realms. So when he's called the Lord of the Gods, he's actually only the Lord of the Tavatimsa realm, which is just one of, it's like the third level of the gods or something like that. Or in the Buddhist cosmology, virtually every time when we hear about the gods, generally they're almost always the Tavatimsa gods. Something like that, but maybe, and they also use their proxies, because the four great kings, so like he was with one of the four great kings there, so they're like the kind of, again, the lower level again. And then you have all these other levels, which you really just like the Tusitar Devas, the Yama Devas, Parinimita Vasavati Devas, and so on, who really are little more than a name. We hardly hear any stories of them at all. You know, we hear they're listed in the groups of cosmologies, but we don't hear any stories about them. Supposed to be from the Parinimita Vasavati Devas, but that's a later kind of thing. I mean, the idea there is because that's the highest level of the sense sphere world, so he's like the kind of the Lord of the sense sphere, yeah, so he has to be in the highest level of that. So he's got like a rebel outpost on the in the fringes of the Parinimita Vasavati realm. Although that's not made clear in the suttas themselves. But if you look at the way that the heavens and the different realms are talked about in the suttas and also in the post-canonical literature, it's actually much more flexible and open than, you know, than like a particular system of cosmological levels. And even if you look in books like the Petavattu and the Vimanavattu, you know, you have stories of like someone who's reborn as a preta during the night time and a deva during the daytime, yeah, and all of these kinds of things. And there's all these different realms, and you find these lists of gods, like in the Brahmajala Sutta and other places. These kinds of gods, like the Kidapadosika Devas, the Devas corrupted by play, yeah. So where do they fit in, yeah? And the Manopadosika Devas, the Devas corrupted by mind, yeah. And so there's all these different kinds of ways of talking about devas, and then in things like the Atanatiya Sutta and Mahasamaya Sutta, all these many, many names of devas and things, some of which fit neatly into the cosmology and other ones don't. So, I mean, I think the picture is really much, you know, very, very complex.
More than I was really busy being a friend, because he wanted to make sure that Satchaka got it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
It's really great friendship.
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah.
One thing in this qualities you mentioned, before you attend Nibbana, it's insight
mm-hmm.
knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that we are contemplating anicca, viraga, nirodha, patinisaga.
Now, insight in meditation, is it?
I'm not sure what the question you're asking is.
They are attained, this insight attained during meditation.
Uh huh.
And then from there, you attain Nibbana, is that something? Not attain, you go into Nibbana.
Or whatever, but again, I'm still not quite sure what question you're asking.
High insights you get.
During meditation? Maybe not. Yeah? I mean, yes, typically they're things that you formally develop in meditation, but when the actual insight hits home, can be any time. You know, you do work during your meditation, but there's plenty of stories of people who became enlightened when they just, you know, like Ananda is just lying down to go to sleep, or, you know, it can actually, the insight itself actually happens at any time. So that's like the fruit, the actual work is done mainly during the meditation, not only during meditation, but mainly during meditation when the work is done. But when the fruits of that work appear, Often is not during meditation. Often it's when you're not looking for it.
So we were talking about that last night. Most like perhaps, you know, that you put the work in and then you relax the mind.
Yep.
And then that sort of, it just sort of tilts the mind in balance.
Yep. Sneaks up on you. Yeah?
So you can open the need to the bathroom.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's the Eureka principle, and it's exactly what the how it happens. Yeah. All righty. Let's finish by paying respect.
Patipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho sarvaṁ na